The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
Well, the attack order came down late Friday night. The U.S., France, Britain launched a total of 105 missiles at three chemical weapons facilities deep inside of Syria. Explosions could be seen, could be heard inside the Syrian capital of Damascus, with coalition firepower making really a mockery of Syrian air defense. We're going to shoot them all down. Yeah, you didn't even see it coming. Here's how the attack went down. While Syria scrambled to hide their military hardware within the safety of the Russian bases, all eyes went to the growing U.S. naval buildup in the Mediterranean. One Russian admiral even threatened to fire a torpedo at the USS Donald Cook, which was parked alongside the USS Winston Churchill. Now, both destroyers appeared to be holding the fort until the cavalry, or in this case, the armada, arrived. But it was all a ruse. The attack order was given, and U.S. naval ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf went into action. At the same time, B-1 bombers launched from Qatar began dropping air-launched cruise missiles that are state-of-the-art. They've never been used before in combat, and it was a masterstroke in precision and modern warfare, and exactly what you would expect from somebody like Defense Secretary Mattis. So, what happened? Well, after nearly a week of the coalition threatening a possible strike and an equal amount of time hearing Russia threaten grave consequences, we're left with a few realities. First of all, I mean, it was cool. It was cool to see that, you know, we fooled them, and cool to see the new technology, but it was impressive on that level, but it's not going to stop Assad from killing his own people. It won't scare Russia and Iran from supporting him. And both the U.S. and Russia came out kind of looking silly in this whole story, because we're fighting like school children at the U.N. And the hard reality is both of us really don't have the motivation or the balls to go all in when it comes to Syria. And that's a good thing. For several days after the April 7th chemical attacks, the West went all Wyatt Earp, you know. Wyatt Earp, you know, with an English accent. I'm coming, and hell's coming with me. Then Russia barked back as if they were Curly Bill, and really nothing happened. At the end of the day, our attack was minimal. It was borderline symbolic, and for Russia, they got their bluff called and got punked in front of the entire world. But both countries are not willing to go to the mattresses in Syria. And again, that's a good thing. Now, Russia has threatened a response, but I think you can take it to the bank that that response is going to come in the form of a cyber attack. So that could be problematic. When and where it happens is anybody's guess, but that is Russia's main strike weapon. It will be fought with ones and zeros. Meanwhile, the real war in the Middle East continues to build, and the real war is Iran's biggest goal in being in Syria, to encircle Israel. The longer Assad stays in power, the larger the Iranian presence will be on Israel's border, and that is what the world and the media should be watching. The Israelis are going to be forced to strike. Russia and the U.S. don't have a dog in the Syria fight. But for Israel and Iran, Syria is everything. And this is the fight we must watch. The coming Iranian-Israeli conflict could and will affect the entire world. We pray for Israel today, and pray that our leaders and our media and our fellow citizens are keeping their eye on the ball.
It's Monday, April 16th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
So the reaction was interesting, to say the least, on this Syria thing. I thought it was a yawn fest. It was kind of like, you remember when we had Shock and Awe? And everybody's like, oh, shock and awe, man, it's going to be Operation Shock and Awe. It's going to be the full force and might of the United States military. And then it happened, you're like, yeah, that was interesting.
It's possible things like Independence Day have skewed our,
yes,
our impression,
yes, yes,
of the U.S. military. Yeah.
Have you
bit.
Ever seen Darkest Hour? It's much better. Okay, this
not
is
really
real.
A movie. These are, yeah, real things happening,
right,
to people.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they hit three sites, right? So, I mean, this was not a...
I saw the before and after pictures. You were impressed. I wasn't.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's some potentially impressive things about the technology,
yes,
that are,
yes,
you know,
okay,
how
right,
precise the missiles are. However, yes, whether that is, you know, that doesn't necessarily say anything about,
yeah,
the scale of it. I mean, again, what they themselves are saying, look, mm-hmm, we hit three targets. Mm-hmm. We told everybody in advance we were going to hit chemical weapons outlets. All the information is that, you know, they were able to move a lot of this stuff outside and bring it to Russian bases. We talked about that last week, mm-hmm, so that they would make sure that it wouldn't be destroyed. So, I mean, is it? It's another message, right? The Trump administration did sent a message last year, which apparently they did not listen to, and now we're going to try another one that was a little bit bigger.
Can I ask you a question? What is the message? I'm assuming you saw this because this was big news, at least in my house. What was the message that Alex Jones was sending?
Well, I think the most important message, as always, when it comes to InfoWars, mm-hmm, he's always going to focus on the most important message.
Yeah.
It was a very emotional day at InfoWars.
Yes.
And
yes,
I would say this is my top story of today.
Is it?
It is.
Yeah, this is a good one. This is a good one. Not my top story, but it is a good one. Here is, first of all, Alex Jones was very upset that we went to a missile strike in Syria. And first, can we have the one that has about six words in it that you're allowed to hear?
Oh, yeah. This is Alex Jones yelling as he responds to Syria strikes.
Okay.
Is there nobody here in this world? See, now I'm pissed right now. Syria,
hold on. We need to stop for a second. Hold on one second. Hey, hold on one second here, because to set this up, he's not actually on the air here. It's important to know that he is broadcasting. He's doing like a Twitter live feed.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not his actual show.
Mm-hmm.
He has just turned on the feed and, mm-hmm, is off the air,
mm-hmm,
talking about Syria,
mm-hmm,
as it comes down. Now, if you don't follow these things, and why would you? But if you don't follow these things, the conspiracy angle here, it has been since the beginning that Donald Trump is right for not being quote unquote tough on Russia, which I don't even think you can say anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But Donald Trump is right for not being tough on Russia because Russia are the good guys. Russia are the people who are in there. They're the ones who are fighting ISIS. They're the ones who are doing all the right stuff. We're doing the wrong stuff.
Yeah. So this is the one reason why I am playing this, because I mean, I know you and Pat have like a club where you get together, I think, every Tuesday and just play clips.
So fun.
But I don't subscribe to that.
Yes, you do. Bull crap. You most certainly do.
Not
we're
like
an
you
hour
guys.
One break one, and you're letting me play this.
Yeah, yeah.
You
yeah.
must enjoy it.
No. This I enjoy.
Okay.
This one I enjoy. Because he's out of his mind nuts, but also I think it's important to show, and there are other sites that I have read in the past that I'm reading now, and I'm like, I think these are Russian operatives. I mean, it is so clear that we are the bad guys and that Russia is the good guy,
mm-hmm,
and Putin in particular is the good guy, that it's remarkable. So here he is on a tirade of being so angry that we would betray our Russian allies. Mm-hmm. Listen.
They fought Al-Qaeda. They fought ISIS. They fought it all. And now you got Mattis and all these people all over us. And the liberal fascists censoring us everywhere the last 2 days. We did an emergency 36-hour broadcast trying to stop this. That could lead to World War III, and you liberal pieces of you support this you degenerate and Mueller and Comey and you. Every major analyst, mm-hmm, see, I shouldn't even be on air right now. Every analyst agrees that this could trigger World War III unlike anything in our history. And the Russians were the good guys battling ISIS and Al-Qaeda. I'm not a Russophile. I've never been to Russia. But I've studied the geopolitics. They are the White Knights. And our military years ago joining the Russians to block Obama and the Arab Spring and do the right thing, did the right thing. And now, Mattis. And Mattis looks like a Emperor Palpatine. And that knows full well that Al-Qaeda and ISIS staged all those chemical attacks. And now they're blaming it on the...
Wow. Okay, so stop. I can't take it. That's how deeply some Americans are marrying in to the Russian storyline.
These chemical attacks were
staged. That we knew it, and that we are the bad guys, and that Russia, the good guys. Now, play the second clip where he breaks down. Now, this is him on the air, where he breaks down, and he's sitting next to, I don't know, somebody else, some guest, and the guy is just looking like deer in a headlights, like, I don't know what to do here. But listen to this.
It's the opposite of what my ex-wife says. She says, you know, oh, the system took the kids away from me. No, you got the kids back because of who I was part of the time. And then they sit there and they're like, you know, if you just turn against Trump, things will be better. But he was doing good, and that what makes it so bad. Oh, and that's what makes it so bad. If he'd have been a piece of crap from the beginning, it wouldn't be so bad. But we made so many sacrifices, and now he's crapping all over us. It makes me sick.
So,
and, but by the way, stunning update in case you didn't know, the man you just heard in those last two clips lost his custody battle.
Yeah,
a real shocker.
Because of who you are sometimes, his wife says. That's what he says.
Yeah.
Because of who you are sometimes. No, I think it's who you are all the time.
Yeah. This is not a mentally healthy person.
No. And he is turning on Trump because Trump is betraying him with Russia. That's phenomenal. That's phenomenal coming from an American, I was going to say broadcaster, but whatever he is. That's truly phenomenal. And as dangerous as anything that the Weather Underground was doing, I mean, this is now an operative, just like the Weather Underground and some in the 60s were operatives for Russia back then. And spreading all the praise and glory to, you know, Lenin. Now it's just Putin.
I mean, the
same
Russians
story.
Are the White Knights.
Yeah.
I mean, what an incredible world he must live in to believe that. The Russians are the White Knights.
Coming up in a few minutes, we have an incredible, incredible show. We have three people coming up that I just can't wait to talk to. One of them is was a Disney princess. Remember, Planned Parenthood came out and said, we need a Disney princess that has had an abortion. Well, she was a Disney princess. And she did have an abortion, and she said it was the biggest mistake of her life. So, Planned Parenthood, you want a Disney princess that's had an abortion? We have her coming up in just a few minutes. Also, Amy Chua, she is the author of a book, Political Tribes. This is really fascinating. She believes pretty much, I think, pretty much the way I do, that we are just separating ourselves in tribes, and we have to come together because it's what's made us unique from many, one, e pluribus unum. Well, she's written an interesting book that explains to the left, I think using their language, who we are on the right and how Trump supporters really felt and really feel, and how we need to understand that to be able to come back to each other. How we come together, coming up in about 45 minutes. And in hour three, Greg Gay, or his name now is Greg Barrett, but his legal name is Greg Gay. He is the guy in Houston that says the school superintendent of the Katy Independent School District has no place talking about bullying because he was a horrible bully himself. This is going to be a fascinating interview coming up in hour number three. Right now, let me tell you about FilterBuy. FilterBuy. If you have really bad allergies, one of the best things you can do is change the filter in your house because it's filtering all that gunk out of the air. When was the last time that you changed the air filter? If you're an employer, when was the last time your building changed the air filter? I want you to think about the employees that you have or your kids. I've been trying to get my son, who has horrible allergies, I've been trying to get him to go to the doctor to get shots because it's the best thing that I've ever done for my allergies. He won't do it. Okay. What about the filter in the house? The filter in your house can make all of the difference in the world. And FilterBuy is America's leading provider of HVAC filters for homes and small businesses because they make it easy for you to improve the quality of the air that you breathe. Plus, they save you money because it reduces the wear and tear on your HVAC system. Now, when they say small businesses, I can't imagine a bigger HVAC system than what we have. Have you seen our HVAC system in this building? We have 90,000 square feet. And this monster in the back, and FilterBuy actually makes the air filters for us. They're all made here in America and shipped for free within 24 hours. And you can also set up auto delivery and save 5% because I always forget. You'll never need a reminder again, which normally comes in the form of itchy eyes and sneezing or a huge repair bill for your system. With over 600 sizes available, including custom options, there's nobody that can help you more than FilterBuy. That's filter, BUY.com. Filter, BUY.com. FilterBuy.com.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Back.
Some sad news today about Barbara Bush. She's in comfort care, not doing well. She's a great lady, and our prayers are with the Bush family today. So who came in with us and who was against us on the Syria thing?
Well, it's an interesting list of countries supporting the Syria strikes: US, UK, France, Germany, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. Canada, Japan, Spain, Australia, Israel, Denmark, Bahrain, Italy, Poland. Oppose the Syria strikes. The Syrian regime.
Okay, that's not
a shocker there.
Yeah.
They did not like this.
Yeah.
Russia, Iran, China, Iraq, Venezuela, Algeria, Lebanon, and Hamas. Hamas did not support this action. So what are we doing?
Wow. I mean, that should tell you, if you think that you're on the right side of this and you are siding with Russia, look at the company you're keeping.
Syria, Iran, China, Iraq, Venezuela, Algeria, Lebanon, Hamas.
Wow.
I mean, that is not, you don't want them on your team. That's not the side that is going to, it's not going to play out well.
Wow.
Has it ever?
No. No, it has. No, it is not. We are. First of all, we're going to get down to the hate for Chick-fil-A. I don't know if you've heard this, but Chick-fil-A is just. It's a hate group. It's clearly, and I can explain. I can explain why they're killing all those chickens. I mean, let me just say this, okay? Peter, do I need to say more?
Yeah, a good amount more. Yeah, that's just one name.
You can't tie Peter to the Chick-fil-A sandwiches? Why are they killing all the chickens? What happened? Peter was minding his own business. He was fine. Everything was going great. And then a chicken, bark, 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 three times. And what happens? Damn right. It was the chickens It was the chickens that pulled that whole thing down.
Damn right might be the right way to say that.
You think so?
Yeah.
I still can't come up with why the pickles are on the bun. But I know there's some religious indoctrination going on there with Chick-fil-A. We'll get to that coming up in a little while.
That is a strange choice. Is it not? Pickles on a chicken sandwich?
I do think it's like that. The reason why we're bringing this up is because there's a Christian infiltration going on with Chick-fil-A.
Thank you.
Some people up in the Manhattan area are very concerned about the Christian infiltration.
The country's on the side of seeing it as a Christian infiltration. Iran, Syria, Iraq, Hamas.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
So a few weeks ago, Planned Parenthood came out with a tweet that said, "We need a Disney princess that has had an abortion." Now, I'm just thinking that maybe we shouldn't go down that road. But, you know, that's me. Well, Deanna Falchuk, she is she's a woman who was a Disney princess. She played Cinderella in the, I believe, Orlando Park for quite a while. Thought she was in love, got pregnant, and I'll let her tell the story. But she is a Disney princess that had an abortion. And so, Planned Parenthood, here's your dream come true. Let's go to Deanna. Hi, Deanna. How are you?
Hi, Glenn. I'm doing great. Thanks.
I've read your story, and it's truly remarkable. Can you kind of outline the story about, you know, you were 22 years old, you're working at Disney, this is your dream job, and what happens?
Mm-hmm. I was actually 18, and I was fortunate enough to get this very exclusive job as a singer in the theme park at Disney World. And what I did was I sang, you know, Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty, and I loved being there. But shortly after that, I started dating this guy who was 22, and I ended up becoming pregnant. And I made the decision to have an abortion, and unexpectedly was immediately devastated, and ended up continuing to go back onto the stage, trying to sing happy songs and dance. And about 7 months later, I just couldn't take it anymore. And I was devastated. And so I ended up quitting the job that I loved and breaking up with the guy and basically falling into a puddle, just trying to reconcile my decision. But the one thing that I'll have to say is that the reason why this tweet really bothered me was because I really believed that part of my decision-making process was based on old rhetoric and propaganda that Planned Parenthood has used for ages. And in my case, it was this anti-mother messaging. When I was a child, I wanted desperately to be a mom, but the messages that I constantly got back were, you know, you can be anything you want. Why would you want to be just a mother? And, you know, you have to wait till you become a mother, till everything's in line. And this is basically a strategic messaging. And so the people who were telling me that, it wasn't even their original thought. These were things that had been written through Margaret Sanger and other people that were trying to champion this pro-woman but anti-mother messaging. And so when I heard the tweet, I was like, oh, no, not again. So, I mean, not our princesses.
Deanna, it is the part of your story that really connected with me because as a dad, I have heard my daughters struggle with that. I have heard my daughters say that. I mean, one of my daughters wanted to get married, you know, while she was in college, and she wasn't going to. And I said, why? Why wait? There's nothing better than marriage. When you found the right person, there's nothing better. And she said, Dad, I mean, you just don't get married when you're my age. Look at everybody will look down. And in fact, her professors, when she said, because I just said to her, I can't believe my daughter just said this to me. There's nothing better. If you believe he's the one, get married. And so she did. And her professor just looked down on her when she said, hey, I'm not going to be here next week because I'm going to be getting married. The professor looked at her and said, wow, okay. And this was a Catholic university.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, like I said, we think these are our original thoughts, but even what your daughter was saying, I mean, this has been written up on, like, when we should have children, when we should form families, how many children we should have. I mean, there's a baby code written by Margaret Sanger. She wrote this is her title, The Wickedness of Creating Large Families. And yeah. She says the most merciful thing that the large family does to one of its members is to kill it. I have a large family now. I mean, I've been redeemed through this. But what you're saying regarding your daughter is very true. We think that we're, you know, that these are our thoughts, but we're really being inundated with, you know, strategic messaging that's going to tell us when good is evil and, you know, evil is good, when it's not even true. We have to really get, you know, start to think independently as to why we're thinking these things. And then so for them to say, let's create a princess that, you know, has had an abortion, it made me think that they're conspiring around a table trying to think to rewrite these amazing stories that have been really positive for women to persevere through unplanned situations in their lives, to battle and slay dragons in order to accomplish things. When things are unplanned and unexpected, that they fight through it, and at the end of the day, they become victorious and find their destiny at the top of the castle. And so we don't need to rewrite things that, you know, women can just discontinue or not push through and battle. That creates strength and resilience and true power and empowerment to be able to look at life and say, let's move through this together and let's get through this. And that's what we learned from our princesses.
And you should be learning from the princes, if you will, that they also do the same. And the guy you were dating was not acting as a prince.
No. So he, you know, basically knew where I could get my problem taken care of. And
is that what he said to you?
At the time, yeah, pretty much. And so I just, you know, was lost. I didn't really know what to do. And I ended up, you know, making this decision. And then, you know, as I'm, you know, curled up in a ball crying, he's out there playing, you know, games, you know, video games and that type of thing. But I mean, what you said about the prince is very true. I think those characters have been bashed a lot too. And the truth is that the prince came down off of the castle to find, you know, an orphan girl in the cinders with Cinderella. So there's a lot of redeeming and amazing traits with these princes that we can learn from. But, you know, that's not often told. There's a lot of bashing in these stories.
It is amazing to me that that stories like Cinderella are completely they're completely changed in some regard. We only focus on the fact that the prince came and rescued her, but he actually didn't. She was amazingly strong the entire time. I mean, she battled her way through obviously death in her family, an awful stepmother. She made the best of things and was the strongest in the movie, not the prince. The prince fell in love with her, I think, because she was strong. And yet that's not the message that we are told Cinderella is about.
No. No, and it's so true. We see the sparkly icon with, you know, the glitter, but I'm writing a story, a book called The Cinderella Mindset, and the one thing that I talk about, I really focus on the fire, on her being in the fire and persevering through that. Like, even though the evil stepmother and stepsisters are like, you're not going, they're basically trying to steal her destiny, she calls upon supernatural favor. I see it as the Holy Spirit, and yet she makes her way into that place, into the castle, and she demands her happily ever after. And so, you know, you can interpret it one way, or you can, you know, you can continue to princess bash, which is what they've always done. And now they want to get into the game. They want to take the identity of the princesses that they've been bashing and try to make their agenda, which is more similar to the evil that is told in these stories. It's not going to work.
Deanna, as you, after you had your abortion, and you are on stage, and you're singing about someday my prince will come and everything else, and you know that the guy you thought was a prince is there working at, you know, right there, that had to be mentally exhausting.
Glenn, I mean, it was grueling. It was devastating. The emotions swirling around in your mind, you know, but I was, even at the age of 18, a professional, so I continued to dance and sing. But that was what, you know, I realized I couldn't. It was just like this fake smile. And to try to push through your smiles and being the great Disney employee that I was. I mean, Disney to this day is one of my favorite places. I mean, we live right here. But it was devastating. And that's why I ended up walking away from the castle, which, by the way, represented for me personally massive success, because I always loved Cinderella's, you know, story. And I had my own personal story as a child of really having struggles and believing these stories and the lyrics of the songs. And then so there I am, leaving my dream place. But there was a happy ending. I went on to get married. I gave birth to two children. One, I ended up conceiving when I went back to Disney for the first time. And that was a miracle story. So God kept redeeming me and redeeming the story. And then I went on to adopt five children.
Wow.
One from Guatemala, who was born to a 14-year-old girl. And if we had followed, you know, Planned Parenthood's, list of who should or should not have kids, she would not have been born because her mother was 14. Three children who watched their mother die of AIDS, and then one child who was labeled invalid in the Ukraine.
Oh, my gosh.
Just for his, and abandoned at 2 days old. And they were about to transfer him to a place where they told us that he would have been dead within 6 months if had we not come when he was 5 years old about being transferred. So our lives have been redeemed. And I've learned through these experiences of persevering to adopt these children, because it has not been easy. It's been a battle. And then parenting them and seeing what the orphan mindset has been like, and teaching them about they can do anything and they can, you know, rise to great places. So I've learned, I've been refined into, you know, a strong woman of God. And yet I've learned, I brought them to Disney to live near Disney because I wanted to live here so that they could hear those messages. I want them to know that dreams can come true.
We're talking to Deanna Felchuk. She is, she was a former Disney princess, that had an abortion. So she's exactly what Planned Parenthood is saying they're looking for, although I don't think that they would agree with that message. Real quick, Deanna, can you talk to the people who were like you that are confused and afraid and just kind of going down this path, and it's because you don't have a child when you're so young, you don't have a child when whatever gets you into the Planned Parenthood office. Can you speak directly to them?
Yeah. First off, I would just say that you're not alone, and you don't feel isolated. Speak to somebody. There are many, you know, pregnancy centers that want to help. But philosophically, I'd like them to understand and to really break down their thought process. And I would tell them that they have a sacred gift to create, and never to underestimate the power of what gifts can be received by walking through the so-called mistakes or messes of your life. Move forward. Choose to make something beautiful from the unplanned and unexpected surprises that come into your life. They aren't always there to take you out. Sometimes they're there to refine you. Stand tall, walk through the fire, and you will come out on the other side sparkling bright in your predestined position. And probably enveloped with your miracle around you. And so I would just...
Go ahead.
I would just say yes, and I would just move forward and say and choose life.
Deanna, thank you so much. God bless.
The NFL chick wrote this for the Federalist, and we'll tweet that out from at World of Stew and at Glenn Beck. Her Twitter account is at Deanna Falchuk. She's definitely worth a read. It's a pretty amazing story and a brave telling of it.
Also the author of To Be a Mother. All right, I want to tell you a little bit about Simply Safe. Last 2 weeks, Simply Safe has won the Editor's Choice Award from CNET Magazine, PC Magazine, and Wirecutter. I've been telling you for a while, this is an amazing product, cutting-edge technology, and now it's been recognized by the industry. Simply Safe was put through a battery of tests, and they were compared to all other security products for your house, and Simply Safe won every time. Simply Safe. In my opinion, and now I'm joined by some people who actually have credentials, it's the best home security system, hands down. I've worked with the founders. I've known them since they've had 2 employees or 10 employees. Now I think they have 600 employees and protect 2 million Americans. This is home security that you want in your home. This is home security at its best and unbelievably easy to use and also unbelievably inexpensive. This isn't a gadget. It's comprehensive protection for all of your windows, your doors, your entire home, and your family. 24 hours a day, 365 a year, and their professional monitoring is $15 a month. Not 50, $15 a month. No one else is doing this. You'll see why the experts have picked them as the best in home security. It's simplysafebeck.com. Save a buttload of money at simplysafebeck.com. Take 10% off now at simplysafebeck.com.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
Welcome to it. Glad you're here. Thank you so much for listening today. We have a couple of things. The hatred for Chick-fil-A has gone into insanity. It really has. It's gone into some sort of a mental disorder. We'll have that coming up. Also, Amy Chua, she is the author of a book called Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. And she describes America, and she's really pegged us on what's made us different, what's made us, honestly, better than other countries, been able to pull together, and what's happening to us now. And she's written it, I think, so the left will understand who we are. She's coming up next.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
Out of all of the infuriating things about America right now, there is one that rests high above, towers over all the others. Of course, I don't even need to say it. You can say it with me. It is, of course, the looming problem of
terrorism.
No, Chick-fil-A.
Oh.
Chick-fil-A. Okay, remember, the late founder of this restaurant chain had the audacity to believe in the American dream. Wow. Now, imagine the audacity of Truett Cathy and his company, and the audacity of his company to exploit America's free market system by making a good product that people actually want to buy. Imagine that. Then to slowly grow their business over several decades from a single family-run restaurant to the third largest fast food chain in America behind McDonald's and Starbucks, providing hundreds of thousands of jobs along the way. How dare they? But I haven't even scratched the surface of the evil of Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A remains closed on Sundays. As if this was still the Eisenhower era where it was common to believe in God or something. Now, by closing on Sundays, Chick-fil-A is clearly preaching the Bible. Now, I haven't been to Chick-fil-A lately, but I have done my homework here. just in the last couple of days, because the New Yorker is very upset about Chick-fil-A. So I haven't seen it myself, but I am sure that they are checking your Jesus card before you're allowed to place an order, right? No shirt, no shoes, no savior, no service. New. What backward hicks? I mean, we can't allow this to go on, can we? Well, we can in the South, but now they've crossed the line, okay? Now they've dared to open 4 locations in Manhattan. Hello! Don't you realize that we have declared that island godless? And you are not allowed to have pickles on your chicken sandwich, because we all know that is pointing to our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Now, this tragedy, I read the description by Dan Pippenberg, Bring. He's one of my favorite, Pippenberger Bring or something. I love all of his writings in The New Yorker. And he wrote over the weekend, and, you know, I see his point. It's almost as if Nazi recruitment centers had opened in Manhattan. His article is titled Chick-fil-A's Creepy Infiltration of New York City. And that is the feeling I get from Chick-fil-A. Creepiness. You know what I mean? Especially cows. Cows with paintbrushes on billboards? How'd they get up there? How do they hold the brush? It's that kind of creepiness that really is freaking me out. But that's not what he's talking about. He, of course, is talking about Chick-fil-A's, quoting, pervasive Christian traditionalism. Man, he says their headquarters in Atlanta are adorned with Bible verses and a statue of Jesus washing a disciple's feet. First of all, whoa, in New York? Really? No, it's in Atlanta. But in New York, you have to hear about stories about a statue of a Jew doing service to his fellow man? Oh my gosh, all the humanity. Now, he says that Bible pounding is just below the surface at Chick-fil-A. To think that this poor man and other New Yorkers have to step inside one of these Jesus indoctrination chicken centers for this story assignment. I don't know how he did it. It's cruel and unusual punishment. This progressive has a problem with Chick-fil-A because its founder believed in something. Wow. Well, it doesn't sound very tolerant, and I'm sure the New Yorker... I mean, let's imagine that Wendy's founder, Dave Thomas, was a Muslim. Let's go further to the point of ridiculousness that we didn't know that Wendy had red hair or freckles because she had to wear a burqa and a headscarf. Now, do you think the New Yorker, even at that point of ridiculousness... would talk about the creepy indoctrination that is going on with Wendy's? No. They would celebrate the diversity, wouldn't they? He wrote, "There's something especially distasteful about Chick-fil-A, which has sought to portray itself as better than other fast food, cleaner, gentler, more ethical." Oh my gosh! The worst thing that could happen is somebody trying to portray themselves as that. He's clearly freaked out that someone would dare integrate aspects of their faith and values in how they run their country, their company. I know it's not usually done. I know we don't even usually take our faith and try to live by it in our day-to-day life. But here's a company that shows, yeah, it can be done. Typical of today's journalist, he never pauses to consider that perhaps those ingredients, and not the Colonel's secret herbs and spices, but these well-known ingredients are the reasons why Chick-fil-A lines wrap around the block. And yes, as creepy as it is, even in New York City, Batman.
It's Monday, April 16th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
I am hoping that Amy Chua can spend some time with us today. She has written a book called Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. She is the John Duff Professor of Law at the Yale Law School. She graduated from Harvard. Amy, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. I don't know how much time you have, but I would love to spend as much time as you have.
I have time.
Okay. Your book is great because you talk about the secret of America and how we're really kind of violating that now, really strangely, unknowingly. But you speak to both sides of the aisle, so we can kind of hear each other. It's not a book written from the left or from the right,
and absolutely not.
It's trying to speak the language of both sides. And let's start with the essential goodness of America that you point out.
Right. So I'm not even trying to be both sides. I am just kind of going back. I think we all need to remember what it is that makes America special. And so I actually have spent 20 years studying different countries in the developing world, you know, European countries. And believe it or not, there is something really special about America that I think most Americans don't even realize.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that we alone among the major powers, not France, not England, we are what I call a supergroup. And to be a supergroup, Glenn, it's really simple. You only need to do two things. The first is to have a really strong, overarching national identity, just something that holds us together, Americans. But the second requirement for a supergroup is we have to allow all different kinds of subgroup identities to flourish. So it's like, so in this country, you can be, you know, you can say, I'm Irish American, I'm Italian American, I'm Croatian American, I'm Japanese American, and still be intensely patriotic at the same time. And believe it or not, this is not true in a country like France. Like, you wouldn't say, I'm Italian French. There's no
right.
such thing. You know, and right now, because of the tribalism that has taken over our political system, we're starting to destroy that. We're starting to destroy this connective tissue, this big overarching national identity that we have that is what's made us special. And, you know, your example, you really about Chick-fil-A is also, there's an attack on allowing individual subgroup identities to flourish
right.
too. So it's a dangerous moment for us.
So I thought this was really fascinating. And the most clear I've heard anybody state this, you're saying that a lot of these wars that we have engaged in are unwinnable simply because those nations don't have a supergroup.
Exactly. So one thing that America has done, and so, you know, my real field for 20 years has been, again, looking at foreign policy. And what I try to say is I explain why we have messed it up so much in countries from Vietnam to Afghanistan to Iraq. And a lot of it has to do with we don't realize how exceptional our own identity and history is. So we forget how unusual it is to be this multi-ethnic nation with so many different ethnicities and to have a really strong American identity. So, Glenn, why do you think Libya is now a failed state? We miss this. President Obama actually really honorably conceded this. He said we failed to see the depth of the tribalism. Libya was a multi-ethnic country like we are, 140 different ethnic groups. But the difference is that Libya didn't have a strong enough national identity. This idea of being a Libyan didn't matter to these people. And it just fell apart. It fell apart after we intervened, and we didn't see that. We thought, you know what? They're going to be like us.
Yeah.
If we just take out this horrible dictator, and then we leave and put in democracy, it's going to come together. And it didn't happen.
So
we project that we forget how special we are, and we make mistakes by forgetting that other countries are not like us.
And it seems in a sick sort of twisted way, we understood this with our motivation behind the Sykes-Picot lines and agreement in the Middle East, where we drew these country lines knowing that it would cause warring factions and the dictators would have would be so busy trying to keep their own tribe together that they wouldn't have time to look out. We did know this at one point.
Well, you know what's so funny? The British were the masters of this, actually, because the British, they, I mean, you know, morally, of course, that's another question, but how were they so successful in maintaining this empire for centuries with such a small number of people? I mean, just a handful of British administrators in places like India and the Middle East, exactly what you said. They were masters. They were so conscious of all these little group divisions. But they used it to divide. And you're right. You know, they were like, okay, how can we keep these people at bay? And they actually purposely pitted groups against each other. But we were not like that after we went to the world stage, you know, post-World War II. We actually started to increasingly think of democracy as like this magic formula, you know, that if we, because democracy historically has worked so well for us. So for the idea, we went into Iraq thinking, Sunni, Shias, Kurds, okay, it's kind of a mess, but let's just have some elections. And that was so wrong-headed, because what I've shown is that under certain conditions, democracy can actually worsen group conflict, not make it better.
Sure. Okay, so I want to go to the part of the book where you talk about how the left isn't listening to the right and the right isn't listening to the left, and you describe, especially for a professor, I'm just shocked that you're even allowed to teach.
I get to go back.
you describe what happened with the Trump voter and what's happening with the Trump voter, and try to explain that to a person on the left. And I've not heard anyone in the media do this and do it effectively as you did. And what we're supposed to learn from this, and how you describe the left to the right when we come back. The name of the book is Political Tribes. Amy Chua is with us. Don't hold it against her that she's a Yale professor. She just said, I don't know if they're going to let her back in, but it's a remarkable book. All right. Let me tell you about our sponsor this half hour. It's LifeLock. Another big data breach was in the news. Recently reported that hackers stole information for more than 5 million credit and debit cards used for in-store purchases at Saks Fifth Avenue, Saks Off Fifth, and Lord & Taylor stores. Some of the card information was put up for sale on the dark web as soon as the breach went viral. There are so many threats in today's connected world, and it only takes one weak link. And the criminals can get in, and then they have you before you even know it. This is why there's the new LifeLock Identity Theft Protection, adding the power of Norton Security to help you protect against the threats to your identity and your devices that you can't easily see or fix on your own. And if you have a problem, they have agents that work to fix it for you. Now, nobody can stop all cyber threats, prevent all identity theft, or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But the new LifeLock with Norton Security is able to uncover the threats that you might otherwise miss. So go to LifeLock.com or call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use the promo code BECK for an additional 10% off your first year. That's promo code BECK for an additional 10% off at LifeLock.com.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
Amy Chua, she is a an author of the book Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. In your book, You talk about the left believes that the right-wing tribalism, bigotry, racism is tearing the country apart. The right believes that left-wing tribalism, identity politics, political correctness is tearing the country apart. And they're both right. Can you explain?
Right. So, you know, I'm a kind of person that believes that people are basically good and that so many things that go crazy and that end up being awful and are now ripping us apart actually started off with good intentions that were positive things. So, for example, let's start with the left. Progressives, you know, in the 60s and 70s, a lot of their rhetoric was about equality, and they had a very inclusive. It was about, let's let's include everybody, let's transcend groups so that we don't see skin color. But what happened is that right around in the 70s and 80s, a lot of people on the left started thinking, you know what, all these calls for let's not see groups, let's be equal and all this are actually not helping us. And so you started to see people as the, you know, minorities grew in number. They're like, look at these histories that we're telling about the United States. We are romanticizing our founders. We're romanticizing the Constitution. We're romanticizing everything. And I, Glenn, I think that there's some good to that. It's like, let's, we should talk about the fact that our founders, some of them held slaves. We do have to talk about our native populations. But what happened is they just started going way, way too far. So now if you fast forward to 2018, it's all the way at the other extreme. It's like America is a land of oppression. It's not even, it's not just like, look, we have this wonderful Constitution with these incredibly important principles, which we have repeatedly failed to live up to, which I believe. Instead, it's like this whole thing is a sham. The country is built on white supremacy, and that is playing with poison because it's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So that's one thing that's happened. It goes back to what I was saying is where it's attacking that precious American identity, not saying we need to strive to make it better and to make it reality, but just saying, you know what, let's just throw the whole thing out. And with identity politics, another thing that's happened is, and again, I understand where the left came from. They were like, you know, all this group blind stuff is just being used to block affirmative action. It's just being used by the right to not let us make any changes. Well, fast forward, it's gone too far. In 2018 now, on a college campus where I teach, it's all about groups. If you try to be group transcending, you will immediately be called a racist. Mm-hmm. Because the idea is that you are trying to erase all the very individual examples of group oppression that we've had. But the problem is that the groups are dividing smaller and smaller. And even worse than that, the idea is like, you cannot understand me. You cannot speak for me. And on top of that, the final thing that drives me craziest is the vocabulary policing. So I feel like a lot of people, you know, in the middle of the country who are not on these Ivy League campuses, they are good-willed. They may be anxious about immigration. They may be anxious about our country changing. You know, they may have certain views that I would disagree with. But that doesn't mean that they're racist and xenophobic and homophobic and whatever. But that's the way it goes right now. It's like if you don't say something exactly right or you don't toe the party line, you're immediately branded all these things. And what that does is it drives a lot of people more extreme underground, where there, yes, I think, is a lot of horrible stuff on the right. And there you hear terrible things, you know. So and it's this vicious cycle. So that's half of it.
Okay, so now let's go, when we come back, let's go to how do we fix it? Because Amy, you're one of the few people I have talked to that I think fully understands the problem that we face. And you have a solution. Next.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
We're talking to Amy Chua. She's the author of Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. You also might remember her from Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. Oh, you know, that only sold about 25 zillion copies a few years ago. So she joins us now. Amy's with us.
So, Amy, I have to tell you, I feel like, you know, I'm a brother from another mother with you.
Yes.
because you're so spot on what the problem is, I think, with the political tribes and how we are one half of the country dismisses the other half. We dismiss, you know, the one half of the country dismisses all of the good things that America did. The other half dismisses sometimes all of the bad things that America
exactly.
did. And we've just been pushed further and further apart. So now how do we come together when we each think the other side is the problem?
So there are these fascinating but terrifying studies that I described that show that a lot of this is actually biological, that human beings are tribal animals, that we want, it's almost, and that's not always bad. Family is very tribal, but
right.
positive. And you know,
we had to survive.
Exactly.
You know, prehistoric man had to be.
Exactly. So, but there are some scary tests that show that our brains light up when we stick it to the other side. So there's a lot of this, but here's the good news. I have all these studies that show that we can, as human beings, overcome this tribalism. And there are all these very, very robust studies that show that if you can pull human beings out of their group context, because we're worse when with our buddies, you know,
yeah.
And you pull two people from opposite sides, opposite tribes, and have them interact as human beings. It is astounding how much progress can be made. Now, this is not saying just stick people in a room together, because if you put a bunch of diverse people together of different races and backgrounds, they could just hate each other more. The point is having them interact as human beings. And the best example of this is the integration of our military in the 1950s. That was a time when everybody said, no way, this is not going to work. 90% of America was against integrating our military troops. But they did it, and afterwards they found that the integrated troops were as or more effective than the all-white troops. And when they interviewed and conducted all these studies, it was so inspiring. I mean, this is not just black and white. This is like at that time, Italian Americans had never really interacted with Swedish Americans
yes.
and German Americans.
Yes.
But what they said is, you know what, if you throw us all into the same foxhole or the same bunk and we miss our loved ones in the same way, we're terrified in the same way, and we have to trust our lives to this other person, we don't care what accent they have or what color their skin is. And that's a perfect example, because norms really changed and a lot of bad things happened in Vietnam. But one good thing is people start to see each other as human beings. So I have this one idea that a lot of people were excited about. It's going to sound silly, but like a public service program where you take a lot of children from, say, one part of the country where they're always with their own kind, their own privileged people on the coast or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe force, you know, encourage or, you know, have them go to another part of the country and work side by side with other young Americans on a common project, not in a condescending way, like we're going to teach you, you know, but rather just some common infrastructure or some project together. So I think that we really have to think about this. I think we have to change the way we teach our history. I think we've overcorrected. I mean, when you were saying bad and good, you know, we have to tell the truth, but we have to make people feel proud of being part of this country and not forget what makes us so exceptional about it.
But, you know, I have to tell you, Amy, my daughter challenged me once. She said, Dad, you only know the good stories about America. And I said, honey, you've gone to school. You only know the bad stuff.
Right.
And I said, I'll tell you what, you read the good stuff, I'll read the bad stuff. And by really immersing myself in things like
yeah.
Wounded Knee and really yeah. truly understanding it, I've actually come out more hopeful that we
yeah.
can survive anything if we learn from it.
I could not agree with you more. And what I think we're criticizing the same thing, because, you know, there's a lot of voices on both the right and the left. It's almost like they want to maintain those tribes. So if you're somebody on the left and you wanted to go to Chick-fil-A or read something positive about George Washington, you're instantly branded by a lot of people. You're
right.
bullied. It's like, you're not on our side anymore. You know, and the same thing happens on the right. If somebody on the right wanted to do, you know what, I want to go hear this person speak about Black Lives Matter. No, 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 you can't. And I just think it's that because I wrote this book because I actually have looked at other countries that have actually fragmented and just broken up. And I think
mm-hmm.
that America doesn't realize how precious what we have is. I see people on both sides saying, let's just get a divorce. Let's just break up the country, you know?
Yeah.
And I think they just don't, they're playing with fire. And I understand that. Sometimes you just get so mad at the other side or what people are saying. And then one extreme thing fuels a more extreme reaction, and it just escalates into a place where people are so hunkered at both sides.
So, Amy, I think what stops us from listening to the other side or sitting down, or perhaps it's just saying that you're part of the problem if you do sit down, is both sides feel, and I can speak for the right, I think, on this one, is it feels like, you know, we'll sit down and we will tell you the truth, but, you know, the left isn't going to tell us the truth of what their real intent is. And I think there's a difference between the average person in the country and those who are leading these, you know, these groups, you know, where
I totally agree. I think it's actually a lot of very loud, shrill groups. Even on a campus, I can say that you'll hear these things that, you know, the rest of America will hear about campus craziness, these crazy things that are said. But when I talk to my students in a private setting, in a smaller group, I find that the majority of them, whether they're on the right or the left, are actually very very reasonable. They may have strong views, but they don't want to demonize. But it's often like a very small number of people, almost like bullying, you know. Mm-hmm. And but I think, like, for example, if just like what you just said about, you're a very influential person. So if you just said, you know, I read this book about Wounded Knee or something, try it. You know, that's not a strident thing. It's not taking sides. And I think if even just a few people start to do that, and yes, I think the left is very problematic this way. You know, if somebody, it's not, what I often say is, look, maybe George Washington was a slaveholder, but that's not all he was. You know, it was an amazing story. It was amazing founding. There was so much heroism. And that's like a no-no. You can't say that right now. So there's so much work to be done, and that's partly why I wrote this book.
So, Amy, I have to tell you, I was in, I think it was Denver. Were you with me, Stu?
I think
Denver, and I had just flown in, and an Uber picked me up, and it was a guy who was driving the car, and he was a professor, and he was a professor of Native American studies, and something else, I can't remember what it was, but everything in me went, he hates your guts, Glenn. and I, you know, I would, you know, I was supposed to hate him, I think. But I started talking to him, and he was taking me to a broadcast station, and I could tell that he didn't really like me. And so we just started having a conversation, and I found out that he was from Wounded Knee, that he had done a lot of his studies on Wounded Knee. So we had this great conversation, and he dropped me off at the station, and I said, wait here. When I'm done, I want to show you something. In the back of the car, he didn't know this, but I had one of the 7 Native American guns from Wounded Knee that had been collected.
Wow.
I told him when we got back in the car, I said, I want to tell you something. I said, I don't know if you know who I am. And he said, oh, I do. and I said, let me tell you what I found about Wounded Knee. And I told him the story, and I said, when we arrive, I want you to open up the back. I have something to show you. And I pulled out the gun, and I handed it to him. And he actually wept. He cried.
Wow.
And we hugged each other, and we had a great conversation, and we ended up liking each other a lot. That doesn't mean we agree on everything. We saw each other. I stopped seeing him as a professor, and he stopped seeing me as a guy who talks politics, and we saw each other each as people.
I love that. I mean, that's what I was saying. It's like, I actually try to do that within my own classes. I have conservative students, believe it or not, they take my classes, and I have a lot of minority students because I'm a minority, and I try to do the same thing. I facilitate it. But I say that, you know, I think we all need to elevate ourselves on both sides of the spectrum and be more generous. Because sometimes it's almost like, and again, I get it, you know, it's almost like a game of gotcha. It's very pleasurable to just hate the other side too. You think of sports, you know. I like my story. Your story reminds me of the one I tell that is the same thing. I have this very poor Mexican-American student who is super progressive, who grew up in a trailer park. And he tells a similarly moving story about the people in the next trailer over who were so kind to his family. And they were, you know, very strong Trump supporters that other people would have called white supremacists. But what Gio said is, even though the words they use would, to all my progressive friends, sound horrible and things that they said, at the level of just two human beings, they were the ones that protected us. They were the ones that said, we're going to be here for you. So I love that story.
So we are sitting in a place, you know what, Amy, I'm going to run out of time. We are sitting at a place now to where you just said, I think the key, the language that they might use. We almost speak a different language. I don't know if you're familiar with Jonathan Haidt.
Yeah.
But we
completely agree with him.
Yeah, we speak a different language. And I've learned this by going to all kinds of different churches and synagogues and mosques and listening. And I'm amazed that we agree, I think, on 95% of the stuff. But we think we're farther away from each other because of the language that each religion happens to use.
Yeah.
And we don't understand it. Coming in, we're like, oh, okay, that's weird. No, it's exactly what you're saying, just said in a different way.
Exactly. But in here again, you know, I think that the left and the right has to, they both have to improve. I have been quite harsh about the left, just all this vocabulary policing.
Yes.
It's like the vocabulary changes all the time, and if you slip up a little bit, you know, then suddenly, aha, we caught you. You're racist. And
yeah,
that's not going to help anybody. But I think what that does is it makes some people on the right go too far in the other direction. They're like, you know what? We're sick of this political correctness, so we're going to say this. And then it makes them,
yes,
purposely say incendiary things that,
yes,
then do sound very terrible. So I think we have to just get out of the vicious cycle and just be more generous towards each. I always say, just try to think about what the person is really trying to say instead of fixating on the exact word. You know, where are they coming from? Are they coming from a good place? Because I see so many people coming from a good place who suddenly just get torn down because they get they use the wrong word. And again, I think that's more like bullying.
Amy Chua, it is a thrill to talk to you. The name of the book is Political Tribes, Group Instinct and the Fate of Nations. She has not only diagnosed the problem, but she points to the cure. Amy, thanks so much.
So much for having me.
You bet. Can't believe she's a professor at Yale. How did she get on campus? They find out. Let's keep this interview to ourselves. They find out she's gone. All right, I want to talk to you a little bit about ZipRecruiter. Every business needs great people. I mean, the people are what make your business. It's really nothing other than that. So you have to find the right person. And if, you know, you're like most employers, you know, you've got to fill it right now. There's got to be some better way than just posting your job online and praying for the right person to see it. I mean, we learned from, you know, the Second Amendment debate. There's no use of praying for anything. ZipRecruiter knew that there was a smarter way. You can still pray, but they've also built a platform that finds the right job candidate for you. It learns what you're looking for. It identifies the people with the right experience, and then it invites them to apply to your job. And it's these invitations that have changed everything. And now ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the right person. The strongest applications that come in, ZipRecruiter is the way you find them. ZipRecruiter, find the right person quickly. ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes and industries, and they're going to help you find the right person. And you can post your job now on ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/back. Make sure you include the /back and you'll be able to try it out for free. ZipRecruiter.com/back.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
Can we see if we can get her on for TV tonight? Because I want to talk to her about race and our race relations in America. Talking about Amy Chua. She is the author of Political Tribes. We just had her on. She is right. I mean,
yeah.
I'm in the middle of, you know, we've been working, what, a year on a book, and we're just in the middle of it. And I wish I would have read her book before, because I could have just, you know, said, you know, buy her book instead.
Yeah, or you could just take off the cover and put your face on it, and then like just sell it as like yours.
Can we,
you
know, do that?
Mean?
Can we do it?
I mean, if your face is on,
she's a professor of law, but what does she know?
I mean, it would take her buying the book, opening it, and realizing it's her. I mean,
she'll
she's not going to do that. She's going to see your face in the book and never look at it.
That's exactly
right.
Exactly, and we sell lots. Right. Of, and just look, you just have to maybe we'll just go through page by page and cross off her name, and write yours in. I think that'll work.
But we only sell tens of copies, so
it's true. I like what she was talking about when it comes to seeing. It's not about gathering like a bunch of people who hate each other in a room and having them scream about politics. You don't get anywhere with that. But when you work with someone, when you do something normal, when you have normal human interactions with people you disagree with,
we had dinner.
Yeah,
Make America dinner again. Yeah. We'll see if we have time to talk about this a little bit more. We have a fascinating story coming out of Katy, Texas. A man who says he was bullied by the school superintendent when he was a kid, coming up.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
I want to tell you why what's happening in the Middle East is something that we all need to care about, why it matters to you. Evangelical pastor Andrew Brunson was arrested 18 months ago and sent to a Turkish prison. He was charged with funding a terror organization. Okay. He's a terrorist? Well, he was one of the, quote, terrorists and, quote, jailed in the aftermath of the 2016 failed coup d'etat. Journalists, academics, soldiers, teachers, and Christians were deemed terrorists. According to Brunson, his crime is in fact his faith, his belief in Christianity. He's lived in Turkey now for 23 years, and the Turkish government claims that he's involved with the Gulen movement. In reality, it's likely a power play by the Turkish president, Erdogan, who is paranoid that the coup was orchestrated by the U.S. He's furious. He's also tantrum prone. And he's an authoritarian leader. So, regardless, the persecution of Christians in that region is subject of many conversations that we have here on the program, and also the subject of something that we are going to air soon, Faith Keepers. It's a documentary that we're going to be showing on Wednesday, April 18th. This is an amazing thing on what's happening over in the Middle East that most people are not talking about. They're not showing it to you. We'll have the documentary's producers on the 18th and some of the collaborators on the 19th. And it is eye-opening. In some ways, it makes you ashamed that you claim to be a Christian because of what real Christians are standing up against. It's chilling. But it is also inspiring. Christians in the Middle East and North Africa, and now increasingly in Europe, face hardships of the most depraved and terrifying kind for no other reason but their faith, or miraculously, the lack or willingness to accept another faith. Faith Keepers, it's a metric for the growing persecution that Christians are confronted with every day, just not us. We talk about persecution, religious bigotry. Last hour I told you about Chick-fil-A in New York. Yeah, that's religious bigotry, but not like what's happening around the world. It's crucial that we take notice every time something like the imprisonment of this pastor in Turkey takes place, because it is likely going to happen more and more often, more open, and much more violently in the days to come.
It's Monday, April 16th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
So, a couple of weeks ago, some audio was brought to my attention from Pat, whose kid was in KDISD, the Independent School District in Houston, Texas. And there is a school superintendent there who is kind of embroiled in a controversy now, because a man came to the school district meeting and stood up and said, "I want to talk about the bullying that is going on in schools right now." He called out the school superintendent at the end. I want you to hear the story. Listen.
My name is Greg Barrett. I graduated from KSD in 1983.
I started in 1975 with Mr. Lance. My legal name is Greg Gay. I was bullied, unbelievably bullied. I started out and I had teachers that bullied me. I had kids that bullied me. Even the coaches, I had nobody to turn to. One day at lunch, I had my head shoved in the urinal where it busted my lip. I had laid on the ground in a fetal position as the kids kicked me. I got up, I rinsed my face off. I walked out of the lunchroom, walked straight to the principal's office, and he told me, "These kids will grow up someday. They won't always be like this." But yet, here I am, covered in urine from laying on the ground underneath the urinal. My lip was busted, and they sent me home. Well, I went home, and I got the 45 out of my father's drawer and put it in my mouth. Because at this point, I had nobody in the school system to help me. Is that the way this is going to be? Lance, you were the one that shoved my head in the urinal.
Wow. Powerful, powerful moment. Now, Lance, the school district superintendent, said, no, that's not true. I was not that guy. And thus the controversy. Greg Barrett, the guy you just heard speaking, is joining us now from Houston. Hello, Greg. How are you?
I'm just fine, sir.
That was a powerful testimony. It's my understanding that that was not, you were not going to out Lance Hint when you first stood up. Can you tell us the
Absolutely not.
Can you tell us a story on how you got there?
Well, I was sitting there, I'd signed up, and I was sitting in the audience waiting to speak.
On behalf of Sean Dolan, right?
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Sean was in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And after he finished speaking, Lance, you know, basically embarrassed him and said, "Your deceased son was not even in KISD," which was true, but his son that was being bullied was in KISD, and he was being bullied because he had confided in his classmates about his brother dying of this disease. And so they were teasing him about it, and he was coming home crying. Well, Sean went up there to try to do something, and they denied that it was happening.
And so that, and so when he said, "Well, your dead son didn't even go to school," that kind of angered you.
Oh, absolutely! It infuriated me. I couldn't believe I was watching this happen in front of my face. He was basically bullying him right in front of my face. And so then, you know, I was nervous, and then it turned to anger. And, you know, so when I went up to the podium, I was angry. And then as I was telling my story, the emotions kind of took over because I was like reliving the story. And here he is sitting right in front of me, you know, 5 feet in front of me, and he's smiling. And I could see other board members smiling like it was a joke. And it just infuriated me. So I called him out at the end and walked away before I really got ugly.
I have to tell you, we've watched it over and over as a crew here, and we had the opposite. None of us were smiling. We were horrified by the story. Now, he denies that you even went to school with him. Does he not?
Yes, he denied anything towards this whatsoever. And we've had multiple people come forward. Some of them I didn't even know. But one man, Chris Dolan, who is not related to Sean Dolan, came forward 2 years ago and invited me to a car show here in Katy out of the blue. And I went, and he gave me a big hug, and he said, "I am sorry for the way that you were treated." And he said, "I'm sorry I didn't stand up for you."
So he was not part of that urinal kicking down.
No.
But he didn't.
No, he came into the bathroom as I was walking out.
And he has lived with the cowardice, his own cowardice. And that's what he was apologizing for?
Yes.
Can you tell me, Greg, I'm shocked that the superintendent has not admitted this. You have a district judge in, I think, Louisiana, or is he, what is he? Is in Alabama?
I think it's in Alabama.
And do you know him?
No.
And he has come out and said this is exactly who this guy was. He was a bully. Who is Mark McCool, which I have to tell you is the opposite of your name? I mean, I would have paid to be McCool as my last name. But
I've told him that. I've told him that.
So who is Mark McCool? Do you know him?
I know him through my sister because they were in the same grade.
Okay.
But I never knew this happened to him until just the other day. He travels. He drives an 18-wheeler.
Okay.
And so he just happened to be here and saw all of this and posted his story as well.
And what's his story?
Well, he was walking home from West Memorial Junior High, which was the same school I went to. And Lance and his buddy, which were in high school at the time, were down at the bayou. And when they walk home from school, they have to walk across a pipe to cross the bayou so you don't have to walk through the mud. And they were trying to walk across the pipe, and they were yelling at him and hollering at him, hoping that they would fall off the pipe. And when the Mark McCool and his friend got to the other side of the pipe, they shot him the finger and ran. Well, Lance and his buddy, they chased him down, caught him, held him at knife point, and made him go back to the bayou and roll all the way across the bayou in the mud to get to the other side.
One more story. There's also somebody that came to attention, I think, from the reporting on a Fox station, that there was charges that were filed against the superintendent when he was, I think, 18 years old. And he apparently was racing his car loudly down a street, and some neighbor came out and said, "Knock it off!" And he backed to stop the car, backed up, and beat the guy into a 5-day coma.
Yes.
For some reason, there were no... I guess battery charges, or the charges were dropped. And so he's kind of denying this as well. But there seems to be a pattern here on Lance.
Yes. And that was settled out of court for the man's medical bills.
$30,000 of medical bills, by the way.
Yes.
I'm curious, Greg, if you had brought up this incident from your childhood with Lance, and Lance, instead of blowing it off or smiling, had responded, "You know, I was a really bad kid. I did some really terrible things. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm taking bullying seriously now." And you learned his lessons from those days and tried to utilize them today. Would your reaction have been different? What would you have taken from that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I forgave him a long time ago. You know, I forgave all of them for what they did many years ago. That was all water under the bridge until I saw Sean's post about his son and he needed somebody to come forward to bring attention to bullying and how it scars you for life. I mean, this is a scar I will carry forever. You know, these guys are forgiven, but it's a scar I'll always have. And I don't want this school district that my family has been in since 1898, my family has gone through this school system. And you can't imagine the amount of relatives that have gone through this school system. It would horrify me to see something like Parkland happen here.
Greg, we've had people reach out and say that you're just a front, that you've been hired or paid off to do these things, to get at this superintendent because he has taken tough positions. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that's hilarious because I'm the one that keeps saying he shouldn't lose his job. Watch every single news interview. I have always said he is the person to fix this. He went all the way through the system, junior high, high school, being a bully the entire way we know now. See, I didn't know all of this stuff about high school and all this other stuff. I had no idea.
Yeah.
But to me, he's the perfect person to fix this because he knows the loopholes.
I will tell you.
He knows why he got away with it.
I will tell you that we talked about that on Friday when we were talking about you. We said the two of you should travel the country. If he would have admitted and said, yeah, boy, I was a bad kid, and you two are the perfect story. I mean, you're the perfect story. Do you ever think of the principal that told you he won't always be like this? And you're finding out now that, oh my gosh, maybe he is?
Yes, I've thought about that. But some of what that principal said was true, because once we got into high school, I mean, there were a few kids, you know, that still called me Gay Greg or whatever. But we had all matured and, you know, and I mean, it was kind of blown off. But I mean, still to this day, when I go to a restaurant, I don't give them my last name Gay. You know, I say Happy. You know, it's kind of a running joke around here. You know, I mean, you give them your last name Gay at a restaurant, they say, Gay, party of four. Everybody stops and looks.
Greg, thank you for sharing your story, and I'm glad that I don't think that we're the people that that they were. We were when I was growing up as well. We're about the same age, and thank you for sharing your story. And quite honestly, I hope that everybody finds their way to forgiveness, and you all set a great example for the rest of the nation that people can change. Thank you so much, Greg.
Thank you.
So I want to talk to you about Bitcoin. You see in the news, Stu, that Bitcoin now, who was it that just said this? I just read this in one of the newsletters that I get from Palm Beach. I can't remember who it was. Said that cryptocurrency now, it looks like it's here to stay. And, you know, it's not a flash in the pan. Somebody who was notoriously against it. George Soros pretty much did the same thing. He said, oh, that's a big bubble. It talked it down for a long time. And now has just opened up, what, $26 billion fund going towards cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. And what's the price today?
It's been back up of over 8,000.
Yeah.
It's right around 8,000 right now.
So anyway, Bitcoin. I don't know what the future is. I do know this. I do know that cryptocurrencies are a part of our future. I don't know how, but that's why I ask experts. And we actually were doing our homework for quite some time. We found a guy out there who we thought was really, really smart. His name is Tika Tiwari. He's from the Palm Beach Letter. Stu and I read his letter every day, and we're impressed on what this guy knows. And, you know, when we first talked to him, we said, okay, so what do you think's coming? You know, and he told us, and I went home and I told my wife and I said, hey, we should buy this cryptocurrency. I had no idea how to even buy it.
Yeah, no, it wasn't even. It's not. It wasn't available on one of the major. It would
right.
Too many hurdles to clear to buy it.
This is why we've asked for a crypto master course by Tika. We asked him, could you put together a course that will teach you what cryptocurrency is, how to buy it, how to sell it, and then you can take the advice on what to buy or what not to buy yourself. You decide. I urge you to check this exclusive course out now. It is smartcryptocourse.com, smartcryptocourse.com.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
What do you think of the James Comey interview, Stu?
Enthralled, Glenn. Fully enthralled. But I did watch it yesterday. And now that we're on hour three towards the end of the show, and we haven't talked about it yet, it makes me feel like I've wasted my time completely.
Well, I don't want to waste your time. We want to go over it because there are a few clips that we need to play. And I've got a few things to say, as I'm sure you do. We'll do that when we come back.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Welcome to the program. Let's spend a couple of minutes on James Comey. ABC did a 5-hour interview with him. 5 hours. I mean, you want to talk about a grilling? And here are the highlights that we thought were worth talking about. Let's play first Comey on Hillary.
Try to realize that I'm not trying to help a candidate or hurt a candidate. I'm trying to do the right thing. And you can come up with different conclusions. Reasonable people would have chosen a different door for reasonable reasons. But it's just not fair to say we were doing it for some illegitimate reason.
But at some level, wasn't the decision to reveal influenced by your assumption that Hillary Clinton was going to win and your concern that she wins? This comes out several weeks later, and then that's taken by her opponents as a sign that she's an illegitimate president.
It must have been. I don't remember consciously thinking about that, but it must have been. Because I was operating in a world where Hillary Clinton was going to beat Donald Trump. And so I'm sure that it was a factor. Like I said, I don't remember spelling it out, but it had to have been that she's going to be elected president. And if I hide this from the American people, she'll be illegitimate the moment she's elected.
Stu,
the moment this comes out.
Do you even begin to understand that? I mean, he doesn't say it. And then Stephanopoulos gives him this scenario. You know, wouldn't you say it was this? Well, I don't recall that at all, but it must have been. What?
Right.
That's a pretty big decision you made. What do you mean you don't remember?
I guess he's just saying it was a foregone conclusion at that point. Remember, this is the era right after the Access Hollywood tape comes out. She goes to the biggest lead she's had in the entire campaign. And at that point, I mean, it did seem that Hillary was going to win. And so he's trying to make the argument that subconsciously that's the environment I'm in. So I'm sure it was a factor, but he never spelled it out specifically in his head. It's just a weird thing because he goes on at length in other parts of the interview talking about how politics was never a factor. He never considered it. He never thought about politics. He was just trying to do the right thing. But he allows for the idea that the right thing was influenced by politics. So it's a kind of a circuitous reasoning in some ways.
All right. Here is the clip. Donald Trump is unfit to be president.
Is Donald Trump unfit to be president?
Yes, but not in the way I often hear people talk about it. I don't buy the stuff about him being mentally incompetent or early stages of dementia. He strikes me as a person of above average intelligence who's tracking conversations and knows what's going on. I don't think he's medically unfit to be president. I think he's morally unfit to be president. A person who sees moral equivalence in Charlottesville, who talks about and treats women like they're pieces of meat, who lies constantly about matters big and small and insists the American people believe it, that person's not fit to be president of the United States on moral grounds. And that's not a policy statement. Again, I don't care what your views are on guns or immigration or taxes. There's something more important than that that should unite all of us, and that is our president must embody respect and adhere to the values that are at the core of this country, the most important being truth. This president is not able to do that.
Okay, I just want to... Morally unfit. Morally unfit. And I don't want to play, well, you guys did it too, but would Comey say that Clinton was morally unfit? Because did you hear what he said? He's got to treat women right.
And he lies all the time.
He lies all the time. Bill Clinton?
Clinton, completely unfit by that standard.
I mean, we'd all agree that Nixon was unfit.
Mm-hmm.
How about LBJ, who was
a
horrible, horrible racist. Mm-hmm. Horrible racist.
Unfit.
Who lied? Unfit. Mm-hmm. How about treat women and lies all the time? How about JFK?
Mm.
How about FDR, who had a mistress on the side? How about FDR, who lied about a lot of things? How about FDR, you want to talk about a bad guy, just scooping up the Japanese, even though his own administration said there is no threat from the Japanese, and puts him in an internment camp because he's a racist? How about Woodrow Wilson, who is constantly the fifth greatest president of all time?
Surprised we ended up with Woodrow there.
Yeah.
I'm really stunned in your list.
I mean, I'm morally unfit. Yes. I wonder if he would put others in that category.
It doesn't seem like he mentions a couple times talking about how he would single Trump out as opposed to other presidents he served under or presidents from history. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone would come out in that way, but he did signal Trump out as worse a couple of times. And you kind of hear
that's saying something.
Yeah, like you see both sides.
I mean, it says something about him, yes. Not about Trump.
He says something on both sides about Comey, too, because there's two parts of this. One is, let me give you 2 points. One good for Comey, one bad for Comey. Comey is, I think, you hear him throughout this give ground. Like, mm-hmm. For example, he says Trump is an above average mm-hmm. Intelligence. Mm-hmm. And he, mm-hmm. You know, when he was talking, there's another clip that everyone was playing about mob. Just he's like, he's not a mobster. He just demands loyalty like mobsters do. He constantly was equivocating and giving ground, mm-hmm. which to an average person, remember, 99% of people don't sit around and think about these issues, don't mm-hmm. know Comey's background, don't know him as a quote-unquote mm-hmm. grandstander, just we'll see a clip of him. And I think that helps him as far as credibility goes to the average person who doesn't follow this closely, because he's willing to say things that I think hurt his case at times. Mm-hmm. He went on at length about how, well, I wasn't sure if I handled something, you know, something right, where he was talking about loyalty, the loyalty pledge conversation, which was reported that he kind of, I'll be honest with you, and that's it. Comey's actual quote was, I'll give you, he agreed to giving him honest loyalty, which I don't know what that means. Exactly.
But different than blind loyalty.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, but I mean, honest, you know, loyalty is a weird thing in that, you know, it's easy to be loyal to someone when you completely agree with them and they're doing everything right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, the loyalty in a way demands in tough times that you're staying with someone. But honest loyalty, okay, it was a, as he put it, a compromise. But it was also something that where he's giving ground, and I think that might connect with the average person watching it for the first time. On the other side of that, he has a problem that someone like Megyn Kelly also has, which is he does not have a constituency.
Nobody likes him.
There's no one who actually likes James Comey.
Mm-hmm.
Even the Comey family, I don't think, because they showed a clip with his wife, who's a huge Hillary supporter. His family, his wife and daughters were marching in the Women's March, right? You think they're happy he released that letter 10 days before the election? I bet you no.
And I just saw a bunch of interviews with people from the FBI who are all mad at him too.
Right. So you have, and now if you think about the normal typical left-right divide in this country, and this happened with Megyn Kelly. Megyn Kelly was loved for a long time because by the right, because she was on Fox and largely was taking the left to task on that show. And she was hated at the same time by the left. They didn't like her for a really long time. Then when she took on Trump, the right said, we don't like you. And the left said, we love you. When she gets her own show and she's past that circumstance, what she has is neither side being passionately for her. And the same thing that happens with James Comey here is that
I listened to a lot of coverage about this afterwards, kind of hear the reaction. And one of the things you notice is the left can't universally bring themselves to say he's a good guy and doing the right thing, because they're so pissed off about the letter 10 days before the election that they can't universally heap praise on him. He's useful to them now. And they will say all the things that he said in the interview were great, but I can't get past the idea that he did X, Y, and Z right before the election. And of course, the same thing with the Trump side of the argument, who, if you remember the 10 days between the letter and the election, he was universally praised by the right. Loved. There are quote after quote after quote after quote about how wonderful this guy was and how he was honest about Hillary Clinton. Now he's a big enemy and everybody on the right doesn't like him. So no one on the right really likes him, and no one on the left can bring themselves to praise him in a universal fashion. So he doesn't even get the benefit of the partisan divide. And I think that is going to be, in the end of the day, you can say that's the right thing to do, but it's not going to make him an effective person in this debate. I don't think they're going to have to still get a lot more than this, because in the end, what he did was further clarify some details of what he already testified about. There's nothing in this book that we haven't already heard. There's nothing in this book that is new, and we are in a culture that needs new.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I've heard the criticism of Comey, which I think is somewhat fair, in that here he is. If this is such an important message, why are you bringing it to us in a book? We're going to make a lot of money. I think it's a fair criticism.
I do too.
But you have to take out the fact that if he really wanted to just get a payday, he should have somehow avoided testifying and telling the story, all these stories beforehand.
Yeah.
Because these are all the stories from the book. And if you watched the interview yesterday, all the stories were stories you had already heard from his testimony. And all he is adding a little bit of color, a little bit of detail from behind the scenes, but really not much more that's new.
So I went to see Bill Murray live this weekend.
Much more interested in that than James Comey. Bill Murray, because I've seen tickets. I wanted to go to the show.
I went.
Bill Murray live on stage? That sounds amazing.
Yeah. I liked it.
Okay.
It was Mary's 30th birthday, so I took her out for her birthday to see that show. And we liked it. A lot of people walked out. It's one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen in my life. Really, truly is. I also saw The Quiet Place this weekend.
A Quiet Place.
Yeah. And I want to talk to you about that as well.
You're not going to ruin it for me,
no,
right?
No.
Because I want to see it. It looks great.
You're not going to tell me everything that happens throughout the entire film. No, I'm not. They all die at the end. Anyway, let me tell you about our sponsor this half hour. It's My Patriot Supply. FEMA is broken. We all know this. Hurricane wildfire seasons are just a couple of weeks away. Yay! Throw a couple of earthquakes and maybe a hurricane, a tornado would be nice. Or a power grid collapse. Wouldn't that be great? Here's the best thing you can do. Prepare, and then you don't have to worry about any of that. This is the week to stock up on emergency food. This week, the Glenn Beck special offer from my friends at My Patriot Supply. Buy 1 2-week emergency food kit and get another one free. Buy one, get one free. Purchase 1 2-week emergency food supply kit, and My Patriot Supply is going to send you the additional food kit 2 weeks free. Call 800-271-63, or you can order online at preparewithglenn.com. That's preparewithglenn.com. It includes food and meal that last up to 25 years in storage. It's really, really good. It's easy to store. It's easy just to grab and go in case there is a problem in your area, a wildfire or whatever it is. Supplies of the buy one, get one free are limited, so do it now. Prepare for the worst and let it go. 800-271-63 or preparewithglenn.com.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck.
So I went to see Bill Murray and friends in concert. And, you know, I was smart enough to go online and look at what does a Bill Murray concert look like? Well, let me tell you, it looks like this. Imagine a school talent show with really unbelievable musicians And Bill Murray shows up once in a while, like every, you know, every half hour, like, you know, 3 minutes. And then there's just some kid reading poetry and he's not that good at it. That's what that's like.
What?
It's the most bizarre theater experience I've ever had in my life.
So is it like a variety show?
No. Well,
he's hosting?
Kind of. No. I mean, I don't know what it is. It's Bill Murray going, I'm almost 70. I'm going to do whatever the hell I want. And it is funny at times, really funny. But he just is reading disconnected poetry and play cuttings and doing songs and then singing, and he's not good, but he's singing seriously. Now, there's a couple of times where he's singing and it's intentionally bad, but it's no different than when he's not intentionally bad. And it's just bizarre. I mean, a lot of people walked out. This couple was sitting in front of me and they were like, I don't know, should we walk out? That'd be rude. And I'm like, you know what's rude? Is you two sitting here talking about it all the time. Just get out. He doesn't care. Just get out.
You already paid him.
Yeah, you paid him. He doesn't care. He opens the show and he's like, okay, all right, the worst part is over, which was not true. The worst part is over. You know, if you need to walk out, I understand. We see it all the time. And so he admits it. He knows it. And I have to tell you, I enjoyed it, but I enjoyed the courage that it took. I thought he was exceptional in parts. He read part of Huck Finn when I can't remember the name of the slave escapes and Huck Finn is on the raft with him. And he reads this whole thing using the N-word and everything. And he reads it really well. He plays all the characters and it's really good.
If you're telling me the hook here is that he read Huck Finn well, that's not exactly a commercial for the show.
No, it's, I don't know how to explain it, except it's like a really weird talent show that it has no theme to it that I could find.
What about the parts where he's not on the stage? What's happening?
The musicians are playing. He's on stage the whole time, but he just sits down in a chair and the musicians are playing and they are awesome, but they're classical. It's a violinist, cellist, and a pianist. And they're playing stuff, and it's bizarre. It's just bizarre. I enjoyed it, but then again, I like weird things.
Right. I would not
recommend this to people who are just like, you know what? I have a good time. Let's go.
I loved Caddyshack.
Yeah, like, no, that's not it.
Okay.
That's not it.
Because I think from a strange, I love who he is and that he just doesn't care about anything anymore.
That's what I liked.
And that's probably what I would get out of that. It's just the balls to go up there and just do whatever you
just
feel
do
like.
Whatever you want.
Because he's beyond FU money.
Yeah.
He's just an FU life at this point. He just doesn't care.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
And tomorrow I have to tell you about the Quiet Place. I saw the Quiet Place.
A Quiet Place?
A Quiet Place. And I saw Rampage over the weekend. I was busy. I had a double feature with my son on Friday afternoon and a night out with my daughter on Saturday. But we'll give you those reviews tomorrow. But if you see Bill Murray, if you come into town, think about it. Watch it online first. You might enjoy it.
Back.
Or you might walk
Mercury.
Out.
Mercury.